Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Devinter Hardawar.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Bernard.
This week, President Obama wins another 4 years. What can we look forward to from his tech agenda? Frankenstorm Sandy gives Instagram growing pains, Microsoft's rumored Xbox tablet, and how can we not geek out over Disney's purchase of Lucasfilm? This week, we're going to forego a main topic and what we're playing with and jump right into the headlines. So let's jump right in here. Barack Obama has won the election. What does this mean to the future of innovation in the technology industry?
TechCrunch. If he really won the election, I think that we still have to see.
Florida, I think, is still in contest. Isn't
what do you have a problem with exactly, Dwayne?
I don't know. I mean, 4 years ago,
Is it the math that's the problem for you?
I was promised an apocalypse if the president was elected, and I haven't gotten my apocalypse yet. So something's got to get.
my favorite comment. Terry about this was some it was a legitimate post on Facebook where some conservative had said, if Obama wins this election, I'm moving to another state.
That's actually pretty funny.
That makes a certain amount of sense though, right? for those sorts of commentators, I guess.
It's better than moving to Canada.
Yeah. Better than moving to Canada.
With socialized health care and
And I love the conservative commenters too, who are like, you know, I'm going to move to Canada because things are so much better there for me.
Because the healthcare, you know, like, what's funny? Ah, it's over. All right, politics. Obama wins.
I want to edit that part out.
what's his technology?
So, there's
so much there.
Yeah. So, TechCrunch's Gregory Ferenstein had put together a post here that he says that based on Obama's record and statements released during the campaign. Here's what technologists can look forward to. Strong support for high-skilled immigration reform. The Startup 2.0 Act is most likely the first opportunity for reform. Specifically, it would increase work visa availability for science, technology, engineering, and math graduates from American universities. Secondly, it would create an entrepreneurship visa for foreign workers who create jobs in the U.S. And finally, it eliminates country-specific caps on visas. Also, open government reform. Obama's Chief Technology Officer Todd Park and Chief Information Officer Stephen Van Roekel will continue to open the vault of government data for the use by the private sector, much like Reagan did for the navigation consumer tech when he released the global positioning system data, and continued support for government investment in clean technology and the technology industry through the Small Business Administration, which gives millions to investors outside the typical startup zones. So it's basically more of the same, I think. I think this would have been a bigger question had Romney won the election than Obama.
Yeah, because the business is very much in favor of the increased immigration, especially the H-1Bs. I mean, we've actually already been hit by that at GroupTi. There mm-hmm. was a woman that we really wanted to hire, and apparently they're out of H-1Bs for at least the next year. Just they're just out. There's no more. So you have we're able to raise money. We got basically everything, but we find somebody you want to hire, and basically just simply can't do it. Like regardless of how good she was. And I'm just like, if us and our random little startup here is getting hit by that, I just can't imagine like how much that's affecting the rest of the startup world. And of course the problem with that is that like jobs, especially high tech jobs, mm-hmm. tend to be multiplicative. Like it's not that like an international hire in an early stage startup is going to replace a job that somebody in the US could have had. It's more that if that company can't hire somebody who can be the very best in the world at that, there simply is not going to be a company to hire the rest of the people that they could have hired.
That's one way to think about it. I don't know. I feel like
yeah, we definitely have to open this up, because the idea of this country is the place where people want to start business because they know it's going to be easy. It's going to have infrastructure. It's going to have all this other stuff like that, with the stuff that helps business move forward. So the idea that you can't hire someone is really kind of ridiculous, because you should be able to hire whomever you want. You're going to majority hire people who are in this country, because that's just kind of how it's going. That's the logistics of the situation. I'd like to see in this, because I mean, everyone talks about education. Everyone talks about how like we're hiring these people from outside the country because they've got these technical skills and everything. I'd like to see some sort of incentive to recruit professors from other countries. Professors in technology fields, because clearly our technology professors aren't cutting it. And I mean by that, I don't mean that we don't have great schools in MIT and Caltech and things like that. But I think that if you're in a smaller institution, an institution that may not be super high and whatever, you should still have access to a great professor. And there are plenty of professors out there in the world who speak English fluently, who have come from other places where this kind of work, this kind of education is really respected. And they can come over to our smaller schools, or even like, you know, our state schools, community colleges, wherever. And we could really get the benefit of their understanding, their knowledge, on sort of that on a level where people are, you know, seeking that first level of educational opportunity. So I'd really like to see, and I'd really like to see what's possible there, because I feel like just bringing people in for the business starting is a great thing, but we've really got to revamp the way we're doing the education, and it's not happening, especially the tech side isn't happening in our more mundane, not super fancy schools.
Devinder, what do you see as Obama's tech agenda coming up, or anything that you're looking forward to that wasn't mentioned here?
I think in general, like there's definitely a lot more support and more attention being paid to startups in general. Immigration is one thing, but I think he sent a really nice note to the New York Tech Meetup, just kind of spurring things on and showing people that he's paying attention to what's happening here. So I'm hoping like there's just more in general awareness of business and this whole new trend of like entrepreneurship, which I think is kind of a cool thing to be.
Sure.
I remember when I was in college, like all the comp sci people ended up going into finance because that's where the money was. And that's, you know, that's where the brains ended up going. I always thought that was kind of sad. Now imagine if all those people had actually spent time, you know, to honing their skills and maybe not contributing to the financial crisis at some point. I'm sure many of them did. And now I talk to kids in college and they want to do startups. They want to work for a technology company or something. So I'm kind of glad that this is finally cool.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. Because of the way the new regulations have happened in finance, I know several people who have left, you know, the banks that they worked at, and they've gone back to their roots, and they're coding again. They're going to SF and they're giving it a shot. You know, they're looking for opportunities. They have more money in their pockets than they would out of college, so they have and they have connections with other people in banks. So they're doing things like starting up businesses. So it's kind of interesting that Devinder, you mentioned that, because I think after all these the regulations got passed, the tone on Wall Street is different. The heat over there is hotter. The national sentiment is not kind of for them as a positive influence in like what's making America great. And I think that some of the people that are over there have left for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I think like just in general, the new if we're talking about how we're building up the American economy and American business in general, I mean, look at the startups, look at the things that didn't exist like 5+ years ago. Facebook is still pretty young. Even Google is a really young company. And look at how much these things are part of our lives now. Yep. So why wouldn't you want to put all the resources you can into building these things? What it doesn't make any sense to me not to.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about Obama's technical campaign?
Sure. The data-driven campaign, yeah.
Yeah, essentially the data-driven campaign. I mean, I was reading an article on Time this morning, and there were a couple last week that sort of begin to intimate, you know, what they've been doing. And it sounds like they are taking the full-on you know, basically data-driven startup playbook and applying it to campaigns with, you know, very targeted the bubbling that Google does, you know, where they take a certain set of people and they treat them all the same way over an extended period of time and see how tests affect them. And,
yeah, it's A-B testing. And, I mean, all their advertising was focused on the idea that they were going to do A-B testing. They did audience buying. That's stuff that we do in our company.
Yeah,
that's Dwayne's thing. I love it when like the idea of big data just ends up being applied in all sorts of different fields. It's kind of fantastic. And it's funny, too, like that the Obama campaign is kind of relying on that so much, having a clear – what I think one of the interesting points was like they had a clear view that the first debate really didn't hurt them that much. And that's kind of an interesting thing to know. Then you don't waste time trying to make up for that, right? And meanwhile, I feel like on the Republican side, there's a lot of – there wasn't much actual data going on. There's a lot of people.
A lot of feelings.
Yeah, a lot of feelings. A lot of rhetoric. People loudly shouting that I am right for some particular reason and having no reason to back it up. I kind of love that data is winning now. And also, what, Nate Silver's, his whole, like, he's been proven right. This is the data election.
Math matters, yeah. The data. Yeah. I mean, Nate Silver, I mean, the New York Times picked him up. I think we're all a little worried about that when that kind of acquisition happens. But they really gave him. They really gave him what he needed in order to realize his understanding of how to like actually quantify sentiment, these key kind of very high level soft understandings, and apply that to this election. So yeah, in terms of what he was able to what Obama was able to do, he was using data in order to get results. It's kind of like what my company tries to do all the time, and. You know, Nate Silver was using data based on previous elections, based on historical stuff. And as people who went to this liberal arts college, we often think about there's hard sciences and soft sciences. Nate Silver's really bridging that gap. He's looking at political science in a way that is quantifiable. Granted, he's using historical data. It's not like but he's using that to make predictions in ways that we haven't seen before. And that's partly because of the tools we have today and all the minds that he can draw from because of the way the internet works. So I know we're supposed to talk about like Obama's tech agenda. We got into politics and all sorts of crap like that. But I do think that
it's all part of the big picture.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I think on the tech side, the president has. I mean, he's spent the single most amount of money on infrastructure and green technology. And that's really, for me, as a person who's living out here in Colorado where it's completely hippie, that infrastructure stuff, it's not small. Man. It's pretty significant. What a lot of these places are doing are they're tapping into the old edge network that AT&T has, and they're using that in order to do things like make pay meters in Denver streets. So the pay meters are solar powered, and they connect to the edge network and use your credit card.
Oh, nice.
Right? So things like that are happening. They're making smarter roads. They're doing all these crazy experimental connected things. Everything's connected. The most mundane thing is connected. We talked to several months ago about how ice boxes are being connected in New York over that same edge network. And I feel like that's kind of where there's no holds barred in terms of like the infrastructure ability. Like if we can make it smarter, then make it smarter. All those IBM commercials you see, let's hope those are government contracts. I guess that's what I'm saying.
All right, let's move on here. So Hurricane Sandy, super Frankenstorm Sandy, swept the East Coast over the last couple weeks. And during that period, 800,000 Instagrams were tagged Sandy. And Instagram co-founder Kevin Systrom thinks that might make the most digitally captured event in history. Go ahead, Chris.
No, I'm just laughing. I guess it would be the most digital. Never thought of their, you know, what was the previous most digitally captured event?
he mentioned in this article on GigaOM that there were previous events like Super Bowls, this was an exponential level greater than anything that had come previous. He said basically that he feels that Instagram is going to need to become a big data company, if they can successfully do that, it could further a shift in how people consume the world around them. He said instead of feeling like you're far away watching on TV, people were participating with Sandy in real time, which is a sea change in how we collaboratively consume an event.
If they didn't realize they were a big data company from like when Facebook paid $1 billion yeah. dollars for them, I'm really kind of worried. Like, what do you think Facebook is doing? That's entirely yeah. what they're buying, yep. people. Ugh. But yeah, Sandy was insane. Do you guys want to hear any firsthand experience?
Absolutely.
I have not heard any firsthand. I've just noticed that Facebook.
Have you guys heard
dead.
Anything on the West Coast? Like, you think this is just like a little storm. Guys, New York City was underwater. Like, literally underwater.
I saw some of the Instagram pictures.
Subway lines were underwater until Monday and Tuesday this week. The L train line wow. between Williamsburg and Manhattan was underwater forever. Like, it's not even up to full service yet. So,
and like,
yeah.
Like, my parents still don't have power, like, 10 days later.
Oh, man.
In Jersey.
And they're in New Jersey, right?
Yeah. It was pretty serious. Like, I have a lot of friends on the East Coast, and one thing that amazed me is, like, there was a huge amount of activity on Facebook and Twitter up until the storm. And then, like, Tuesday and Monday, it was like Facebook was a ghost town. There was just nothing there. It was like, oh yeah, I guess yeah. everyone doesn't have power.
This is like a revolution situation where literally a lot of things kind of just fell apart. And yeah, people were living without power and doing stuff. Like, they had to figure out entirely new ways to live without the love of your smartphone and Facebook and everything. I kind of escaped unscathed here. Like, mm-hmm. I still had power. I still had internet in my particular neighborhood.
That?
Yeah, what?
You know why that was? Because you live in a neighborhood that's called yeah. the Heights. And
yes.
in New York, that actually means something. It means you're on top
yes.
of a hill.
So I'm definitely in a higher elevation neighborhood.
The
so
water
it, that
is rolling
helped.
Down from your spot. And mm-hmm. that's something that techies should be thinking about when they live in temperate climates. I'm serious. You want
to
live
Yeah. So the water is one thing, though. But, I mean, in general, there's not much to cause, like, a tree from falling down. Like, the winds were crazy. I had a satellite dish on my roof that just kind of fell off. And ended up in my neighbor's yard. So that's kind of the only bit of damage I had to deal with. But yeah, guys, this was the craziest thing I've ever seen. I've lived in New England, you know, my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been through blizzards. I've been through some storms, through hurricanes that hit Connecticut. But this is insane. We've never seen this before. One thing I do want to mention is, like, it's kind of amazing how people kind of just rally together to kind of help. Mm-hmm. The tech community in New York kind of did a good job with that, too. The New York Tech Meetup, a whole lot of groups. Everybody just kind of put their skills together. There's a great technology story here. I wrote some of that up at VentureBeat. It's kind of cool. And I think, you know, this storm and also this election kind of shows us we got to pay attention to data. Guys, like, this is our future. You know, we have to build the infrastructure. We have to build the emergency response to withstand things like this and also to kind of trust the data because we knew this was going to happen. For a long time, we knew storms like this were coming, mm-hmm. and I feel like New York didn't really prepare for it, but yeah. we'll see.
Have you guys ever read
Obama mentioned this specifically.
You go first, Wayne.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was just saying, Obama mentioned this specifically. He, he alluded to it in the code that politicians use. He goes, "We want our children to live in America that isn't burdened by debt, that isn't weakened by inequality, and that isn't threatened by the destructive power of a warming planet."
Yeah.
And you talk to people on the East Coast – when they were doing the exit polls, and Sandy actually mattered to these people.
Yeah, I just wanted to come out and say it, but we had some really big things, like Bloomberg, you know, here. Bloomberg, this guy is a business dude. He's a Republican. He endorsed Obama, and he explicitly mentioned climate change as one of those reasons. I think that and Chris Christie's support in New Jersey, like, it's kind of a shame that it takes one of America's greatest cities to be literally underwater
one of them?
For people to kind of like, yeah, say, hey, maybe this global warming thing is actually happening. But yeah, hopefully after this and we'll see some sort of change going on. But
and
man, we have
Louisiana
infrastructure
got hit
problems,
by a superstorm and it got destroyed. Mm-hmm. And it just got, but the thing is, it got destroyed on someone else's watch, and those people don't respect the kind of trouble that the earth is
right in. Right,
so that's, you know, there's this connection of between like politics and technology and, you know, nature. For me, this technology and nature is a huge thing. I love employing technology to get the most out of nature, thus my Fitbit craziness. But what I'm saying is you're gonna see, like, different politicians deal with it completely differently. When the data began to show that the 9/11 workers were empirically affected by having worked on 9/11, you know, the Bush administration did nothing. that when that data was like brought up again, the Obama administration signed a bill making sure the government covered those people's health costs. Like, it's all about who's looking at it and how they want to interpret it and whether or not they see a threat to whatever special interest they have. New York isn't a special interest. It's the greatest city in the country, if not the world.
Sure.
I feel like it's a sad thing that Louisiana, the whole thing, New Orleans especially, got destroyed. And people were like, oh,
right,
that sucks.
Guess we
you know what I mean?
Really help that. But,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, but, like, I guess we couldn't help it. That's
yeah, not
so
to discount that, but, you know, hurricanes have happened there a lot. And, you know, storms like that, we've seen the southern part of the U.S. get hit quite a bit, and they rebuild from that damage. But, like, New York and New England was never prepared for something like this. Like, this is just not supposed to happen. So it seems kind of unreal in a way. But, Chris, you were going to say something, too?
Yeah. Well, I keep thinking of the I can't remember where this quote originated from, but it was a quote about, like, so like 90s was the steroids decade, you know, Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire. You can't say which home run was due to steroids and which home run wasn't due to steroids, but clearly the overall net effect was, this is unhuman to be able to hit this many steroids. And, like, that's the best analogy for thinking about Sandy. Like, you can't necessarily say which hurricane was due to global warming and which one wasn't, but when you have, like, a Katrina and an Irene and a Sandy within, like, 5 years of each other, like, gee, you have three once-in-a-hundred-year storms in a 10-year period. I wonder what's happening.
That's
there.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Second thing, which I think it's not just a technology or a science thing, but I think actually it almost gets back to the data thing we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. One thing I've realized as I've gotten older is that we humans, and honestly even those of us who are fairly well educated about this stuff, we're very bad about making numerical estimations. Mm-hmm. Like, we're pretty good with sort of like linear models of like, well, if I do more of this, I'll do more of this. But we're really bad with like exponential models, like imagining things like you know, the 1% thing, the fact that, you know, 1% of America is owned by just a ridiculously tiny number of people, or the fact that a small change in you know, the carbon in the atmosphere can have a huge effect or whatever. And I think a really good sort of like point for beginning to understand how to think about it is the Foundation series. If you've ever heard of that,
wait, hold on. Did you just say, if you ever heard of that? It is the foundation for Star Wars,
who do you know
Star
who you
Trek.
Are. Yeah, who are you talking
about? It's literally the foundation of all science fiction that we like watch.
I've just discovered recently that there's an awful lot of people who never heard of it.
Yes. Only geeks have mainly heard of it, but yeah.
So make sure that your friends have read it. Not just you, but make sure your friends have read it, because it's a great book and it has really aged well, despite the fact that it's almost 70 years old at this point.
It was
started during the late 40s and ended during the 50s. But it really like captures the importance of just how much data analysis and data can actually affect human history. And obviously it's science fiction, but it gives you that sense of just like the importance of data and analysis of data in human history, especially when applied to the soft sciences. Like, I think we all like – we just sort of expect Moore's Law to happen.
Right.
Like, we're okay with that sort of data analysis happening in the stuff like engineering, but we need to realize that like – data analysis is not something that should be limited to just technology and math and physics, and it should be affected to like populations and money and sciences and biology.
Well, that's where data
anything else
becomes really important, because data. Okay, so like when you think about a clock, you think about an analog clock, and you're like, oh, it's so imprecise, and then you get like these really high end atomic clocks, which go through things to like the hundredths of the second, like, you know, the tens of thousands of seconds or whatever. They're really precise, but what that digital clock is doing is that it's attempting to directly quantify time, which is why it's very nature analog. The entire world is analog, which is why it's been so hard to measure things throughout all of history from a numerical or digital point of view. Numerical is always digital. And so what we've got with this amazing ability to calculate things, Amazon's EC2, all this stuff, is that we can now look at things that are completely analog and seem to have no pattern, and literally crunch the numbers to determine whether or not there is a pattern. And that's kind of where the big shift is. So I completely agree with you, Chris, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, the whole, you know, like Asimov, he didn't go into the inside baseball when he went into this technology, because that would have ruined his book and made it so that it didn't last for 70 years. But what we have today is the ability to see things that are really, really, really not technically seeming at all, and look at them from a technical perspective and make judgments. And that's what's so amazing.
I feel like I agree. By not going into the details of how this sort of data analysis work, he was able to understand and explore the idea of, like, well, what if the ability to process data was, you know, vastly larger than it is right now? And the amazing thing is, he wrote this like before people really understood what computers or anything like that was. And honestly, at this point, we have data processing power that's unimaginably greater than what he was thinking about. So that needs to get us thinking about, like, gee, what can we, you know, do that that he couldn't even imagine.
It's been a while since I've read those books. I'll have to add those to my reading list.
It's definitely good right now, because the very first book opens up with I forget the main character's name, but he goes to the main planet, and everybody's looking down at their, like, screens.
Yeah, and not Trantor, where that's where he's
yes.
at.
Yes, yes. And it's so great, because it's like, I'm reading this in New York, and that's what everyone's doing everywhere.
How and everything runs prophetic. On these amazing batteries that never die.
Yep.
Everything's an iDevice.
And they're all following their invisible the lines that tell them where to go, which is basically everybody trying to get anywhere with GPS now. It's
that's going to be Google Glasses in a few years.
My God, I hope not.
All right, let's move on here. In other Instagram news, they've launched web profiles. Simply put, it's everything that you know about your profile page from your Instagram mobile app, but on the web. Until now, users could only access Instagram photos on the web through a simple landing page, only including the photograph and comments alongside that post. Beneath that, all your photos are laid out on the page, organized chronologically and grouped by month. The most interesting part about it, though, is that it seems like something straight from Facebook's visual identity playbook. Topping each user's profile page is a mosaic of large format images that kind of cycle out through the images, much like Facebook's profile revamp from last year. What's interesting about this is that, you know, up until now, Instagram has been like they've resisted having any sort of web presence outside of a link to individual photos. You couldn't sort of drill down into your profile at all, and now it's basically like they busted out from the web app, I mean from the mobile app, into a legitimate online presence, and it feels a lot like Facebook did, you know, a year ago when they revamped their visual identity with the timeline. Have you guys checked this out?
It actually hasn't fully launched yet, so we haven't had a chance to really check it out. I think it's launching soon, but it looks nice and it seems inevitable. What's funny is I see people freaking out about it. It's like, oh my God, my Instagram pictures are going to be readily available. If you haven't privatized your Instagram feed, I am amazed people are complaining about this. But yeah, I guess that's how it goes.
Anything I take with Instagram, I intend for public consumption, and I've checked out mine. If you go to, you know, you just type in your username, like instagram.com/MrBabyMan. And I think it looks great. It looks fantastic. I think this is a great move for Instagram. And I think it's probably a necessary thing for them in their move to becoming a big data company, as the Kevin Systrom had.
But aren't they already tied to a big data company, as in their owner and master Facebook?
Yeah, no, they definitely are. But you know what? I'm glad that they're having separate Instagram profiles instead of like immediately shoving them within Facebook. Right now, just exploring anything you have on Instagram through the web is a pain. Like the easiest way to do is if you tweet your pictures, you can go through your Twitter to find your Instagram stuff. Right. But beyond that, there's kind of no way to do it. It's really annoying.
All right. We're going to take a little break here. And before we move into some more headlines, including the Disney acquisition of Lucasfilm, let's talk briefly about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com. And for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't, by Nate Silver. And as we've spoken previously on tonight's episode, Nate Silver is a statistician who runs the New York Times-hosted 538 blog. He famously predicted the final outcome of the 2008 presidential election to within 0.4% of the popular vote, and has again accurately predicted the state-by-state winners in this year's election, and all of this based on statistical models. He's basically done for political forecasting what Billy Beane did for the Oakland A's. In The Signal and Noise, Silver examines the world of prediction, investigating how we can distinguish a true signal from a universe of noisy data. I have not personally read this book, but I'll bet you at least one person in this room has.
Not yet, but you know what? I am definitely planning to. I kind of love that after one of the really funny things Nate Silver did on Twitter was like kind of after the election was called, he was like, you know, maybe this is a good time to say, buy my book, guys. And it's now, I think it's number 2 on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. And why not?
There was a time, I think yesterday, where he was driving something like 20% of traffic to newyorktimes.com was going
insane. So this book or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles can be yours. All you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook and the free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. If you don't like their service at all, you can keep the audiobook for life. So you can order The Signal and the Noise and keep that forever and ever, even if you don't like the Audible service. All right, let's take a brief break here, listen to some music, and when we come back, Disney and Lucasfilm and an Xbox tablet. What's up with that? So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Devinder Hardawar, Dwayne DeFreitas, and Christopher Bernor. And let's talk about Disney and Microsoft. Disney and Lucasfilm. Oh.
Yeah, that's a very different deal you're thinking of.
Freudian slip there. So media giant Disney has purchased Lucasfilm for $4.05 billion in cash and stock. During last Tuesday's press event, it was also announced that Lucasfilm is working on Star Wars Episode 7, targeted for release in 2015.
Dwayne does not like that.
So Disney plans to release a Star Wars film every 1 to 3 years from 2015 on, with Episodes 8 and 9 following. Disney will take ownership of Lucasfilm and acquire the entire portfolio of Lucasfilm technologies, including products like THX Sound and divisions like Industrial Light and Magic, Skywalker Sound, the LucasArts game studios, and franchises like Indiana Jones. The deal was said to be approved by the Disney board and Lucas, who is the sole Lucasfilm shareholder. This also makes Lucas the second largest individual shareholder with a 2.2 stake. So this is like this. This was one of those moments where I will never forget where I was when I heard this news. And like I was at work, and my production secretary mentioned this to me, and I had to have her tell it to me like several times because I could not believe that it was happening. And
this is a where were you moment. Like this same thing happened to me. This guy at my job, he's an EVP of sales. He works for Disney up until last year. He's like, hey, did you hear about the Disney thing? And I'm like, what? And I'm standing there with another friend of mine at work. He's a geek. Right. And the world stops for a moment as it's explained to us that Disney bought Lucas. And at first I thought he was lying to me. I thought he was joking. I went through the whole thing that you go through when you go through.
Yeah.
I went through denial.
Yeah, exactly.
I went through like acceptance. I went through all these like emotions. And I just and you know what? It sounded like such a joke because he said they not only did they buy it, but they're making episode 7. And I'm like, that's just – I mean
– And it's coming in 3 years.
It's coming in 3 years. And the very idea that there could be a Star Wars movie that does not begin with the Fox fanfare is ludicrous.
That was one of the first things that I thought is, wow, this news is really awkward for 20th Century Fox.
Well, it's funny that at least you reacted that way, Dwayne, but I guess I shouldn't be surprised. But isn't this technically good news? This is like the best news the Star Wars franchise has had since the prequels have ended.
We are, you and I, Devendra and I, made a pact a long time ago to make enough money to save Star Wars. Whatever that cost would be. And if anyone can do it, it's going to be the guys that were able to take Iron Man and do what they did. It's going to be the guys that were able to take so many of these wonderful
This was before Iron Man. This was before they bought Marvel. So, Iron Man happened before they bought Marvel.
Yeah, it did. But they still, like, the Disney logo still at the end and everything
right.
like that.
But I mean, the big thing is that these people have Pixar, right? This is the creative minds behind Pixar, just imagining them, just messing, having the potential to mess with the Star Wars universe, having like Brad Bird, like that is one of my top choices. Or I think my big one is Gore Verbinski, because I think this guy is fantastic. He did I mean, the first Pirates was amazing, the second two had major script issues, but he did his best. Rango was fantastic. I even love the ring was like one of the best horror movies we've gotten. He's a really great director and he's good with Disney, so if I were to bet who would be doing the Episode 7, it'd probably be him.
Well, let's not forget Andrew Stanton, because even though he had a terrible time, you know, it's hard to live down what happened with
I think Disney wants to forget Andrew Stanton.
Hold on, let me finish. Even though he had a rough thing with John Carter. John Carter was actually the type of film that if he was treating a Star Wars movie with that kind of respect, the way he respected Edgar Rice Burroughs' work, I don't think we'd be that disappointed.
John Carter was the proto Star Wars.
It was. I mean, that's a longer argument. I actually really like John Carter. I think it's a really fun movie. But I can see why it failed. Just in terms of who you'd bet on, Dwayne, I don't think Disney's going to bet on the guy who basically lost them hundreds of millions of dollars.
I'm not saying that they're going to use him. I'm just saying that I wish that he was able to. They had the timing had worked out so that he worked on Star Wars 7 instead of John Carter, because I think he could have taken that to a whole new level.
I think we've all kind of one way or another played who would direct the next Star Wars movie when we heard about this news. And one name came to my mind that I think might actually be a good choice is Martin Campbell, who directed Casino Royale and
After Green Lantern? That man is dead to me. Okay. What are you talking
Casino
about?
Royale was,
but hear me out. Casino Royale, GoldenEye, the Mask of Zorro, I mean the Mark of Zorro, both
Mark of Zorro. The Zorro movies were fun. Dwayne is a crazy person when it comes to these Bond movies. Yeah, I agree. Casino Royale is amazing. But the thing is, by the way, I saw Skyfall. It is probably the best Bond movie ever made. So just be ready for that. But the thing about Martin Campbell is that he needs to be surrounded by good people, by a good script, by people who know exactly what he's trying to do. Because if he doesn't have that full range of support, he will make something like Green Lantern. And did you guys see Green Lantern?
I actually skipped that movie.
Okay, so Andy, you should skip up on this.
Green Lantern. Yeah, ugh.
But I think with the right writers, and I think it's capable now that Lucas is going to have not direct control, but like consulting control.
That means nothing. You're in the business, Andy. You know that means nothing. You know that he's like in a chair in a corner. and he'll shout, and they'll be like, yeah, yeah, George, whatever you
exactly.
say.
Which is good. That's a good thing. And I have to say, before we get too deep in this conversation, that full disclosure, I am a Disney employee.
Yeah, so. You technically work for the company that now owns Star Wars.
I work for the company that owns everything, apparently. Yeah. So, yeah, yeah, no, this was terrific news. I was, like, stunned by this. It took me literally a few days to process this the scope of what's going on here. But I think it's terrific news for the Star Wars franchise. The only thing that I had hard time figuring out is why George Lucas, who built this company up from the ground and owned it in its entirety, and the company was operating at a profit. You know, he could sell Star Wars forever. Why he would sell his company?
There's a story that most of the money that he's earning from it is going to be going towards his philanthropy efforts, mostly towards education. So I think he probably just wants to fully retire and step away and probably do like the Bill Gates thing. Now he'll have time to actually manage his boatloads of philanthropy ideas.
He
also just needs to get away from Star Wars. I mean, like, nothing's been more destructive. Nothing's been more destructive than his influence in like the last decade. I mean, let's put it out there.
I completely agree with that.
The ideas that he decided to put forth with the new trilogy were, you know, for lack of a better term, pretty awful. The first movie, disastrous. The second movie had the saving grace of the biggest tech battle we've ever seen ever, but you know, it was still kind of ridiculous, and it had the Yoda situation with the lightsaber situation. And the third movie was really the only of the three films that stood up to anything close to scrutiny, not even hardcore scrutiny. So I think Lucas, because when he made the other movies, they were like, you know, the first movie, okay, it was cool, it was awesome. The second movie, amazing. No one will ever deny that The Empire Strikes Back is the best Star Wars movie ever made. One of the best science fiction movies you'll ever see. But, you know, you get to the Ewoks on Endor, and you're kind of like, what's going on here? And that was Lucas saying, I need those toys. You know what I mean? Or you get to whatever Obi-Wan Kenobi is riding in episode 3, and you're like, what is going on? So I don't know. I feel like it's time for him to pass the torch on the professionals.
I'm not sure exactly why he did it, but it definitely feels like, I mean, it's scary having your like prized possession passed to somebody else, but like, I don't know. I feel like I'd rather have it passed to Disney than a number of other film studios that would just, like, you know, profit war it to death.
Yeah, well, I mean, Disney could potentially do that too, but I think what we've seen recently is that, you know, with the acquisition of Pixar, with the acquisition of Marvel, Disney is now in charge of all these just kind of huge properties.
They steward these properties.
And they're sort of the best studios to do that. What's really funny, though, is that how much did Disney pay for Pixar? What, $7.4 billion? Disney paid almost twice as much for Pixar, an offshoot from Lucas, than they did for Lucas's actual studio. I think that is hilarious, guys. And didn't Steve Jobs paid like $6 million for Pixar back in the day or something? Wow. So, yeah.
I have to say also that I have to give props to Bob Iger. Now, I've been at Disney for almost 20 years off and on, and I was here when Michael Eisner was the CEO. And when Bob Iger came into the company, I had some serious doubts because here was a guy who came from Cap City's ABC, and I wasn't entirely sure. He was a television guy. I wasn't sure how he would manage an entire company with all of its various subdivisions, and in particular, intellectual properties, which have their own set of complexities. But, you know, he was responsible for the acquisitions of Pixar, Marvel, Lucasfilm, as well as, of course, as having traded Al Michaels to NBC Sports in exchange for Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. So I have to give him his.
No such thing as a lucky rabbit.
I have to give him his total his total props here for.
Well, for me, it's not even that. Like, it's stewarding the media. But if you guys think about it, this isn't just about the media. Think about what's possible with Disney World and Disneyland when you have Star Wars at your whim. Not just Star Tours, which you licensed, but Star Wars is completely yours. That's a whole
Indiana Jones
new
adventure
world. Not to like quote Aladdin, but that's a whole new world you build at Disney World. It's a whole new. That's go to Star Wars Land. Like that's a whole new park by itself,
for sure,
with no question.
Yeah. I'm sure Disney's eyeballs were ringing with potential cash opportunities here, for sure. And I mean, the idea, we haven't really talked about this new timeline for movies. It's what, a new movie every 3 years or so?
Yeah.
There could be problems with that, by the way, because that means you're literally, you're just churning it out. Yeah, even if you don't have a good idea or not. So.
Well, if they,
there is
if
a potential
smart,
for oversaturation.
They do a Lord of the Rings smartness thing where they say, I'm going to get, 20 actors and we're going to make a trilogy and we're going to
a written trilogy to go with. And let's see, what was the 90s thing that was really 90s? Popular? The one that was the unofficial sequel to the original trilogy.
The Thrawn trilogy you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, the Thrawn trilogy. Yeah. Right. So they can get Thrawn if they want it. I don't think they're going to use it, but they can get Thrawn if they want it. And if they want to do that, if they want to spend 25 months filming three movies and then do the post production over the course of X amount of years to drop a new trilogy
That's
and then do that again.
Think, but yeah.
It's really hard, but Disney can afford to do it, is what I'm saying.
Maybe it's not really the money. It's not really that. It's the creative juices necessary to do that. It's hard enough to get a script for a single film ready to go and get everything in place in 2 years. Having a trilogy in place, that's going to be kicking off right away. Mm-hmm. That's almost impossible. So we'll see. Potentially it'll be more we'll get the first film and then maybe a Matrix Reloaded Pirates type deal where they do the second two films together, because then they'll have hopefully a better idea of what they're going to do. But we've kind of seen how that turns out too.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting from a geek perspective. I hope they I don't know. Having read so much of the expanded universe, I'm excited to see how they're going to deal with rebuilding the New Republic,
mm-hmm.
rebuilding the Republic. I'm excited to see how they're going to deal with things transparaglass and the way they deal with cloning and all that other shit like that. I'm excited to see how that all happens.
I have to say here as a side note here that George Lucas has spoken in interviews before about how he'd like to step away from the Star Wars universe and pursue some independent projects, get into the type of filmmaking that he was doing before Star Wars. And I honestly would really like to see that, because in my opinion, and this is going to be complete blasphemy here, that I think that THX 1138 and American Graffiti, the two films that he made before Star Wars, are better, more nuanced pictures than Star Wars or anything that he's done mm-hmm. since then.
And but how long? That was 40 years ago?
Yeah.
50
yeah.
almost.
Yeah. I mean that's how long he's been trapped in the Star Wars universe, and that's how long
let's not call it trapped. Well, the man has become a multi-billionaire because he focused on
he is trapped by his own success.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
There's a difference between being, a young film student trying to prove yourself versus, a freaking icon.
That's how long
I don't know if he can do it anymore.
That's how long he's been artistically stunted from growth. Yeah.
And also, he took, a decade, 15 years off to raise his kids? So it wasn't always Star Wars. There were, there were things he could have done. He just chose not to.
And also, George Lucas didn't need to direct three new Star Wars movies. He didn't direct the second Star Wars movie, and it was the best Star Wars movie ever. He could have just produced them. He could have done what Luc Besson does really well, which is to find other directors to take a vision and move forward with it. But instead he chose – I don't see a George Lucas that's I'm starved by the Star Wars thing. Oh, my God. What am I going to do? I can only do this.
Well, because he almost hates his fans, so I'm glad he's kind of just stepping
that's
away.
That's that TA remake.
And we've gone into George Lucas bashing territory.
Yes. Have you guys seen the Go TA remake video of the somebody that I used to know regarding Star Wars?
No.
Okay, it's called The Star Wars That I Used to Know. You can look at it on YouTube. It's brilliant. it talks about everything from Jar Jar to what happened to the practical effects. Now it's all green screen, and it does it to the tune of somebody that I used to know. And it's brilliant.
Are we still going to have Star Wars parodies now that Disney owns the property and Disney is so tight?
No, now we can have legitimate mashups between Star Wars and Disney characters and also mashups between Marvel and Star Wars characters.
Yeah, well,
guys,
that'll be interesting.
Guys, if there is an X-Men in the fucking long, long time ago, to get there's going to be some serious geek terrorism.
There are limited use cases that I'd like to see that in. Like, specifically, for example, like in like a game brawl situation, I would love to see all those characters in a brawl type game. But outside of that,
you're going to see a long, long time ago, there was Galactus.
Oh, no,
all together, guys.
No,
it's one long story. Come on.
Well, I remember seeing a crossover between the X-Men and Star Trek The Next Generation in a book. It was on the cover. And it was all drawn out, right? But in my head, I'm thinking, oh my God, the guy who plays Professor Xavier is the same guy who plays Jean-Luc Picard. What the fuck is going on here? If that kind of shit happens again, I guarantee you I will make my own cell. My own geek cell.
Well, we can only anticipate what's coming up ahead with this merger. My mind is still reeling from it. Let's move on. Let's make this our last story here. Microsoft is building its own 7-inch gaming tablet. Multiple sources familiar with plans within Redmond had confirmed to The Verge that initial hardware planning for an Xbox Surface is underway. The Xbox Surface will likely include a custom ARM processor and high bandwidth RAM designed specifically for gaming tasks. It won't run a full version of Windows, but rather a custom Windows kernel. Messaging and other tablet functions may be supported, but the focus will be on gaming. Provided the project doesn't get killed in favor of a full 7-inch Windows tablet, in the same way Microsoft axed Courier, expect to see the Xbox Surface debut ahead of Microsoft's future Xbox console. So this is really interesting. I can't imagine, like, would this be for casual gaming or... Like, how powerful could a gaming tablet be?
I think there's a lot of potential there because it's Microsoft and it's a company that actually can build accessories and can, you know, this would be the first tablet completely dedicated to gaming. Mm-hmm. Android tablets have good hardware now. The iPads definitely have good hardware, but they don't have hardware fully dedicated to gaming. There were some crazy specs. I don't know if you guys saw some of the stuff that was being floated around a couple months ago. There was the idea that it could also have two IBM chips with 6 cores each and like 5 gigabytes of RAM or some ridiculous thing. Mm-hmm. Like they're basically trying to make a powerhouse machine that you can hold in your hands. I think it's kind of a cool idea, especially if they
also
tie into the Xbox
tablet.
Yeah. Well, and it could also be a great second screen kind of thing to have alongside the next Xbox. And what's really interesting too is that, you know, Nintendo is basically doing the same thing with their Wii U controller thing. Have you guys played around with that yet?
I think there's
the unboxing videos happened today. They'll probably start showing up in stores soon. Mm-hmm. Just so people can test them out. But, you know, the screen itself is basically a gaming tablet. That's all it is. And like, it seems like Microsoft is just
handheld stuff they put, like what kind of, like the controller that they make for this tablet. Obviously you can work on the tablet, but I'm sure there'll be a hardware controller that Microsoft drops that allows you to like take complete advantage, which is really the holy grail, right? It's mobile gaming, but it's like having your living room actually travel with you in full. Lean mm-hmm. back on the couch, stare at your tablet and use your like Xbox controller.
That would be the ultimate potential for it, but also for second screen stuff for the Xbox 720 or whatever. Mm-hmm, too. Mm-hmm,
for sure.
Like it's there's a lot of potential here.
Yeah.
I think this is a big thing for Microsoft. They proved already that they're interested in making their own hardware. I mean, they've always done that with the Xbox, but with this Surface tablet, we see the beginning of that. The Surface is a solid device. People really enjoy it. And the idea that they can take their Xbox product and bring it to that form factor is pretty exciting, especially because it gives their ecosystem a good situation in terms of I have the Xbox tablet. It probably also does normal productivity crap, but I don't have to think about it when I'm gaming. And there's a connection to my Xbox. I can like play with it here. I can play with it there. Maybe it's, you know, I'm guessing it's going to have some smart glass functionality. So I mean, that's the tie-in that Microsoft is seeing is so successful between the Google products and the Apple products. It's they've got to make their situation. They've already got your desktop, your laptop. Mm-hmm. Let's get you on the tablet. Let's get that Xbox really working. And a big part of that is going to be Xbox has all these content deals, and that's going to be passed on to this tablet, you know, with Microsoft's heft and everything. So
I think what Microsoft is realizing here is that one of their strongest brands is Xbox. Like, seriously, like,
if not their strongest.
If not their absolute strongest, especially not just in terms of like recognizability, but also in terms of just like people like it. And, you know, like Nintendo and Sony, they're definitely feeling either the pressure or at least the lack of growth that Apple is showing by sort of really dominating the casual gaming market. And I think they're realizing that, you know, the tablet interface is a pretty good interface for casual games. And a lot of people are willing to play casual games. And it's a fairly big market. So whether or not they are able to pull it off and it actually mm-hmm. happens, you know, I've been around tech long enough to not comment on right. whereof I cannot speak, thereof I must be silent. So I won't comment there. But it certainly seems like a great idea, and I hope they do it. Especially if they can get some like really awesome like you know interface with the actual you know Xbox system.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everything is integrated is going to be integrated. I mean, that's kind of Microsoft's grand scheme for their Metro. That Metro interface is everything's going to be tied in across the product lines.
I got a talking to Andy. It's not the Metro interface. It is the Windows 8 UI.
No, there is no name. There is no official right. name.
Well, so according to the Microsoft guy, according to the Microsoft guys that I know, they refer to it as the Windows 8 right. UI.
But that's kind of right. pointless. The whole point was to have a marketing name so you can tell the consumer right. what they should be excited
I'm not,
about.
I'm not saying what it is it's or what it is. I'm funny. Saying what the guys from the horse's mouth, the Windows
yeah,
8.
I know. It depends on who you talk to at Microsoft because every group has a different name for it. So it's just it's kind of hilarious, I think.
All right, let's wrap this show up here. We'll go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Devendra. Where can we find you when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Sure, you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra. I write about tech at VentureBeat.com, and I podcast about movies and TV and whatever at slashfilm.com.
Cool. Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find you online?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, DWAYNED. You can also find me on flavors.me/DwayneD. That's DWAYNED. So check it out.
Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me tweeting at CrisBurnor, CHRISBURNOR. Mm-hmm. And I've been blogging pretty regularly at CrisBurnor.com. And I co-curate a reading list and event list of startup-related events at StartupDigest.com.
Cool. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, Twitter.com, and Facebook.com/MrBabyMan. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network by going to geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Go to the geeksofdoom.com, and our link, our iTunes link, is in the upper right hand sidebar. Our show's on Stitcher, so you can add us to your Stitcher enabled device at stitcher.com, facebook.com/thedrilldown, twitter.com/thedrilldown. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location for our holiday gift guide episode, where we're going to tell you what we have chosen for you to go out and look for holiday gift picks. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us. Yep, yep.